Welcome to session one of the Rapture and the Endurance of the Saints, a new study, a new series in the Maranatha Global Bible Study Series ecosystem. Joel Richardson and I are going to be tag teaming this study, and we're very excited about it. Joel and I have been processing this for the last probably 2 years in a focused way, this issue of the rapture. What I'm going to do is go through a bit of an overview and an introduction to give a bit of the landscape, the why behind this, the how we're going to do this, and some caveats and some things that I think are important before we jump into this. Each of these sessions is going to be looking at specific issues, specific texts, specific questions. It's going to be a little bit different than our exegetical studies. Now, in the past, in the Maranatha Global Bible Studies, all we've done is just line upon line exegetical teaching, just looking at the scripture, what does the scripture say, and we've avoided thematic Bible studies. And in general, we want to avoid thematic Bible studies. Now, the reason for that is when you're looking at the Bible through the lens of themes and subjects, you end up avoiding or misappropriating the text as it was written. Meaning, you know, you have a couple paragraphs. Now, when that paragraph was written by, say, the Apostle Paul or the prophet Isaiah, that those couple paragraphs are, there's an inner logic that's built within those texts. They're not trying to make a singular point. So when we come and we take those paragraphs and we make it all about a singular point, it's kind of like a cartoon. You know, you try to do a portrait of someone's face and you sketch it or paint it, but you end up overemphasizing the nose or overemphasizing the ears. And it ends up distorting the picture, the character that you're trying to sketch or paint. And I think a lot of times that's the fruit of thematic Bible teaching, is that it can distort certain things. So with that said, we're going to do it. We're going to engage in thematic, but the way that we're going to do it is as exegetical as possible, meaning we're going to look at hallmark passages that deal with the issue of the second coming or the gathering of the saints, and we're going to look at the context of it. We're going to look at all the paragraphs, not just the cherry picking of the verse that is used or counter-used. So that said, that's a little bit of our philosophy. If you're new to the Maranatha Global Bible Studies, you know that our passion is exegetical teaching. Our passion is the authority of the Word, not imposing things on the Word, but looking at what the Word says in and of itself. So what I wanted to do in this session, before we get started, is I'm going to go over three reasons why we're doing this series. Then what I want to do is go through three vantage points of how we're going to approach it, how we're going to look at it, and kind of the method of engaging in this. Then we're going to look at three applications of this, meaning the relevance of it. It's not just for academic hobby or something like that, but there's actual real personal applications for this. And the last thing I want to do is give three caveats, some qualifiers to give some context to some of these things, because this will be a very controversial series. We're going to be addressing this very head on. And I think it's something that, you know, Joel and I are sobered about it. We want to be very careful in how we engage this critical, important subject. So with that, let's start with the three reasons why we're doing this series. Reason number one is this: the issue of Jesus's return, whether you're looking at the Old Testament or the New Testament. Now, in the Old Testament, his return is framed a little bit differently than the New Testament, because it's framed as the coming of the Messiah, coming as the king. And there's a hidden mystery in there of his first coming, where he would be cut off. You know, Daniel chapter 9 says he would be cut off. You know, the Psalms describes him being crucified. We see Isaiah 53, we see him being crushed and broken and slaughtered. There's many passages of this hidden first coming and then a very open, public, visible second coming. Now, that mystery in the Old Testament is very much magnified in the New Testament and explained and elaborated upon.
Hey guys, sorry to interrupt the teaching. We want to thank you for watching our Maranatha Global Bible Study. If you're enjoying the content here, I want to point your attention back to our app, where you can find all kinds of similar and creative content, other sorts of teachings, but also films, documentaries, podcasts, music, writings, field reports, all kinds of extraordinary content. You can find it all on the FAI app, so go and check that out. back to the teaching.
Either way, whether we're looking at through the Old Testament or the New Testament, what we're looking at is this issue of the coming of Messiah at the end of the age as a conquering king. This is, and I want to be very clear about this, this is the central message and the central hope of the Bible and of the gospel. There's no more important message in either of the testaments. Now, the New Testament, let's say Protestant or Catholic theology is very much centered around the cross, meaning the first coming of Jesus. But when we look at the New Testament, the overwhelming predominant emphasis of the New Testament is of the second coming of Jesus. That does not mean that the first coming is of no value. Far be it. No. There is, of course, there's value in the first coming of Jesus. Absolutely. But the overwhelming objective analysis of the New Testament, if you're stepping back and looking at it from a, let's just say, a statistical standpoint, meaning how much is the cross talked about compared to how much is the return of Jesus talked about, you're going to come away shocked if you've never done it before to realize that the overwhelming hope of the New Testament, of the gospel of the kingdom, is the second coming of Jesus. This is the end of the story, the climax of the covenant. This is everything. This is not like an add-on subject. And this is one of the main reasons why Joel and I want to do this series, is because this is the main subject of the story, guys. And you could say, well, the rapture is different. Well, no. And this is why we need to study it, because many people have been told that the rapture is a separate subject, but the Bible doesn't communicate it that way. The Bible communicates that the rapture of the saints and the endurance of the saints that precedes their gathering to the Lord is in inseparable connection to the second coming. Now, we're going to see this over and over and over and over again as we look at the passages throughout the Old and the New Testament, that the coming of Messiah at the end of the age to restore all things, to judge the living and the dead, to fulfill all of prophecy, to bring heaven and earth together, to make all things new. This is the centerpiece of the Maranatha message and the centerpiece of the gospel, the centerpiece of time, the centerpiece of the whole story. And the rapture is a part of that. So we're looking at the rapture in context to and its inseparable connection with the most important reality in all of reality. This is the reality. It's like Moses' snake that swallows up all the other snakes. This message is the message that swallows up every other message. Take another message, this one's more important. Find another emphasis, this emphasis is more important. Find something that is more critical or central to the story, this is the most central. This is, talking in Disney language, there's a reason for the formula of Disney movies. It's the big battle at the end and then the coming of the king who is victorious and takes the girl. That is embedded into the psychology of the human race, is that that's what we're craving. We're craving a big battle and a king who would come and who would make all things new and who would overcome and destroy the evil one and vindicate the innocent and get the girl. That's what we're aching and yearning for. And so what Joel and I want to do is put the rapture in its proper context. It is a part of the greatest story ever told, and it's part of the greatest climactic moment of the greatest story ever told. So in light of that, we need to address the dangers associated with misunderstanding it. So this is the second reason why we're doing this series, is to address the nature of the rapture in light of false teachings. Now, Joel and I have been, have attempted to be very cordial over the years with the issue of the pre-trib rapture. Now, we've addressed it, we've taught about it, but a lot of the circles that Joel and I run in, more so Joel than myself, because of Joel's writing and preaching and teaching and traveling, Joel has been in, has been more privy to it than I have been, but I've been as well myself, is that there's a lot of people who track with us for different reasons who believe in a pre-tribulation rapture, that the church gets taken out and evacuated before the tribulation begins. And Joel and I have felt the tension of this over the years of we don't want to go clash with our friends, but this is a false teaching. And so we've been pretty restrained compared to what we actually feel and believe about the subject, both he and I. In fact, I think one of the first conversations Joel and I ever had was over the issue of the nature of the second coming and the application of the gospel to the second coming in a need for endurance and a cross-centered eschatology. And so in light of that, here's the second reason why we're doing this, is because today, the pre-tribulation rapture teaching, though it's dying, it is dying off, though it's dying off, it is still very, very strong in the United States of America. It's pretty weak everywhere else. Not many people believe it outside of America, but it's very strong in pockets of America. And it is, and I want to say this with gentleness and humility and kindness and gentleness and affection, but I want to say this emphatically and clearly. The pre-tribulation rapture teaching is toxic. It's influenced by demons. It's destructive. It's dangerous. It is not something to be trifled with. It's not a plaything. And it's not also something of, we can just wait and see which one of them's right in the end. And what Joel and I are going to show over the course of 2023 in this study, it's going to be a long study, we're going to show there's implications to this. Ideas have consequences. And I'll get to this when I get to the caveats. We're not saying you're going to burn in hell forever if you don't believe in a post-tribulational rapture eschatology framework. But there are heavy, heavy consequences in believing certain things about God, about history, about the nature of the church, the nature of the Jewish people, the nature of the nations, the unbelieving, unsaved nations that are under the risk and the threat of the judgment of God at the end of the age. The rapture influences all of these things. And there is a lot of toxic behavior right now in the American church because of the toxic doctrine of the pre-tribulation rapture teaching. And if you want to see the fruit of just the strength of the toxicity of this thing, just go peruse the YouTube's comments on rapture videos on YouTube, just to see the aggression and vitriol and the almost to the point of violence. I would say the pre-tribulation rapture camp, like on the extreme side, I'm not talking about your average, you know, churchgoer who's kind of nominal, doesn't really know what he believes, but he just believes it because he's heard it, but he doesn't really have that much passion. I'm not talking about him. I'm talking about the guy that's dug in, that's resolute, that is the pre-tribulation rapture is like everything. That has caused and given rise to a form of bizarre Christian militancy that is going to tear the church to pieces in the days to come. And this is something that Joel and I have just been processing a lot with each other over the last year or two, is like, I think we need to risk it. I think we need to risk relationships for this to stand for the truth of this thing and to address this thing head on. I don't think we can play with it anymore in the name of not offending our friends. So we're aware that a lot of our friends who are either watching this or who are going to refuse to watch it because of the emphasis point of this thing. But we're aware of that. We're feeling it. We're in pain over it. We don't want to go, you know, clash with our friends. But the reality is this, we're beyond the point where we can do it in a clear conscience to just not address it, because the consequences of this thing are going to be so heavy. And because of how toxic and how destructive and how damning this doctrine is. You know, I would put this on par with some other really dangerous doctrines of demons. And what we mean by a doctrine of demons is it's a doctrine that demons enjoy playing with, that they celebrate. They go, ooh, that's a good one. You know, like when a professing Christian comes out and starts spouting, oh, I don't know, something like anti-Semitism, for example, and explaining the reasons why the Jews are the synagogue of Satan and all of these things. Demons love that. They feast on it. They feed on it. They energize, and it creates, there's an energetic dynamic to demonic doctrines. And we can see this through, and this is why Paul addresses doctrine of demons in a number of his epistles. So does Peter, so does Jude. And we're going to look at this in the months ahead. But doctrines of demons are serious. And they cause, it's like blood in the water. And once you start chumming the water with the blood of false doctrine, you start getting a swirl taking place. And the pre-tribulation rapture teaching was, I believe, whether it was born in the flesh or it was born in the psychology of demons, and it was actually played out on the world stage because of demonic orchestration. I could see either of those being true. Either way, there is demonic activity involved in the issue of the rapture because of what it causes people to do when they believe it. And we're going to go through a long list of all of the implications and the fruit of the pre-tribulation rapture teaching in those, in the communities and in the hearts of those who believe it. And the thing is, when you don't see it and you're not aware of it, you don't know it. And then when you see it, it's like, whoa, you know, it's kind of like people coming out, and I don't want to draw too much of a comparison here, but it's like when people come out of a cult. You know, if you've ever watched someone come out of a cult or a very like, you know, different religious subgroups have extreme communities and people come out of it, whether it's Orthodox Judaism or, Islamic extremism, where if it's pockets of, you know, pseudo-Christian cults, Jehovah's Witnesses, when people come out of it, they're like, man, I didn't know. I had no idea the implications of what I was believing because I was in it. I was in the kettle and it was boiling. I didn't know. But when you get out of it, you're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that I actually believed that. And I said that, and I lived like that. And you're not aware of it when you're in it. So one of the things that Joel and I are hoping to do through this is not just, you know, point fingers and say, you guys are stupid. We have no interest in that. We have no interest in belittling, demeaning, demonizing people who believe differently than Joel and I believe. This is not that. This is looking at scripture and saying, look, guys, the Bible says this about the end of the age. It says this about the need for endurance. It says this about the nature of the church, the nature of the church's relationship to the Jewish people, the nature of the relationship of the church to the church, the relationship of the church to the nations. And all of these things get affected very, very negatively because of the pre-tribulation rapture teaching. So again, I'm not going to get into all this now. I'm giving you kind of a landscape. Now, the third reason why Joel and I are doing this series and the reason why that we're doing it now is because one of the things that Joel and I have been dialoguing about over the last, I don't know, 9 months or so is just this feeling, this sense that, you know, it might be more urgent than we think, the hour that we're living in. You know, Joel and I have both tried to be very restrained, you know, and not being hyper, like, you know, store up guns and food and money and build a bunker. It's coming tomorrow. The urgency of the hour is here. It's coming tomorrow. You know, we're wanting to encourage people to go deep in the message of the return of the Lord, but to do it with a marathon pace because we don't know how long it's going to be. And one of the things that we've been feeling lately, and we wanted to be honest with you guys about it at the beginning, is that we feel like it's actually going to be shorter than we anticipated, that we're moving into days of acceleration, that we're moving into days where we're going to see some things happen on the global landscape that's going to very much put us in the next 2, 3, 4 years in a very different place globally. And when that happens, when we find ourselves in the 2, 3, 4 year mark from now, we're going to go, whoa, I can't believe how much happened in those years. I believe we're at a critical moment in human history of rapid acceleration, which means this: the subject of the return of the Lord and the rapture has never been more relevant than it is right now, because we are living in the generation where it matters most. And that's the third reason. We're living in the generation where this subject matters the most. You know, a fascinating subject is global population. If you go back and look at the size of global population, it's really interesting. Now, nobody knows because there wasn't, you know, they weren't taking censuses in 2000 BC, you know, but in terms of rough speculation and, it's really interesting to see how long it took the human race to get to 1 billion people. And then when you watch the bell curve of once it hit 1 billion, and then over the last 200 years, going from 1 billion, 2 billion, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and watching the curve take place, we're living in the most populated generation in human history, but we're living in a moment where it's beginning to, the bell curve of the size of humanity. And the reason I mention that is to say this, why it matters most. Yeah, let's say 200 years ago, you're looking at 1 billion people alive on the earth. And so when we read the book of Revelation and we see in one judgment event, 25% of the earth's population dies, And then we read in Revelation chapter 9, in another judgment event, a third of the earth's population dies. That's a half of the earth's population dying in a 42-month period, according to the book of Revelation. Now, half of the earth's population, guys, think about this, a half of the earth's population in a 42-month period, the difference between half of a billion and half of, say, 10 billion, that's the difference between, you know, 500,000 people and, like, the numbers are, you see what I'm saying? I'm not going to get, it's goofy to get into the numbers of it all because we don't know. But the point is this, is that we're not only is the human race swelling in size, but it's moving rapidly towards all of these things that were unthinkable for 2,000 years. I was talking to a friend of mine about this the other day, just the unusual nature of this. We have tech, I'll just as an example, just an aside, we have prophecies that talk about Israel, Egypt, and the region of Saudi Arabia entering into a dynamic peace agreement and arrangement with one another at the end of the age. And it's that arrangement that the Antichrist attacks that sets in motion the Great Tribulation. Now, for the last 2,000 years, if someone said, hey, look, the Egyptians, the Jewish people, and the Saudis, they wouldn't be called Saudis throughout the last 2,000 years, but you get my point. Egypt, Saudi, Jordan, Israel being in a dynamic, economically prosperous, affectionate peace agreement that the rest of the Middle East despises, you'd go, nah, that's impossible. Even 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. Now, Egypt entered into the peace agreement. This is what I was talking about with a friend of mine the other day. I was like, you know, Israel is moving towards the finalization of the peace agreement with Saudi Arabia. Like, we're looking at things that have not, they couldn't have happened over the last 2,000 years. And one of the responses that people will give a lot, if you say, hey, we might be living at the end of the age, people go, yeah, well, people always thought that. And my response to that is this, it's very important that you not buy that lie. Number one, people did not believe that because the conditions were not set. The prerequisites were not in place. People did not believe that. But number two, it wasn't possible. Even if people did believe it, it doesn't matter if they believe it or not because it wasn't possible for 2,000 years. What's profound is that you are living in the first generation in 2,000 years in which the main prerequisites have been met or could be met in your lifetime, which means this. You're living in the generation where this subject matters the most, more than any other generation in human history. That's profound, I think. So those are the three reasons we're doing it. It's the center of the story, and because there's a really, really bad false doctrine out there that's destroying the very fabric of the story. Now, here's the other thing. It's not, Joel and I are not just countering pre-trib teaching through this thing. We're also countering kind of, let's just say, apathetic ignorance as well. Meaning, like, who knows? Who cares? Like, it's going to sort itself out in the end. If you just love Jesus, it's going to work out. I don't really care if it's this or that, you know? As long as you're faithful, it's going to work out. And to which I would say this, that's actually a false teaching. That's a false teaching. You say, how is loving Jesus a false teaching, Dalton? Well, here's the deal. There's a lot of historical examples where loving God wouldn't have gotten you over the line. Meaning, if you didn't get in the boat, you died in the days of Noah. It doesn't matter how much you loved God. In the days of Isaiah, for example, if you didn't listen to Isaiah, you died by the Assyrian blade, regardless of whether you love God or not. You know, Jeremiah gave very specific instructions to his generation that were very different than Isaiah's generation. And if you didn't listen to what Jeremiah said, it doesn't matter how much you love God, you died with a Babylonian blade to your throat. Your body was thrown into a mass grave. In the days of John the Baptist, if you didn't heed what John the Baptist said and what the Lord said, what the apostles said, it doesn't matter if you loved God with all your heart, there is consequences for adhering to, obeying the specificity of the Lord's commands in moments of significant consequence. Meaning, I don't want to discourage anyone from the simplicity of just loving Jesus. That's beautiful. But the thing is, if you really love him, you're going to obey him. And you want to know what he's thinking and feeling and saying. That's true love. That is true love, beloved. And the idea that you could just love God but disregard what he has said or is saying, that's the false teaching. So that's the second thing. Joel and I are going to be doing that. And the third is because this is the most important time in human history to go deep in this subject. Three vantage points. These three vantage points are also three very strong arguments against the pre-tribulation rapture teaching. But these are also our three vantage points. Number one, you're not going to find the pre-tribulation rapture teaching in the Bible.
Hey folks, sorry for the interruption. I just want to make sure you know that we are hosting a Maranatha End Times Summit in Dallas, Texas this July, July 13th, 14th, and 15th. And you can head to maranathasummit.com to get your tickets and join us there. We hope to see you.
So our vantage point number one is going to be the Bible. Obviously, we're going to be looking at the Bible. The second one is you're not going to find it in church history. You're going to find the first references to the pre-tribulation rapture teaching 200 years ago. That's it. Now, there's debate about which is the first reference. Was it, you know, Margaret MacDonald? Was it before Margaret MacDonald? Who is the first man or woman to address it? Joel and I are going to get into that. But the point is this, it is a modern doctrine. The early church fathers, no one referenced it. No one. There is not a single shred of evidence that anyone in church history before the Reformation, for sure, believed in a pre-tribulation rapture teaching. Every single church father and document that we have for the first 1700 years of church history stated emphatically that the church would endure the tribulation, would face the Antichrist, and would be gathered to see Jesus upon his return, not a secret phantom return, his actual bodily visible return. So it's not in the Bible. Now you say, well, Dalton, there's a lot of preacher Bible teaching out there, and it's really good. You can't just say it's not in the Bible. Well, it's not in the Bible. We're going to go through all of the proof texts. Joel and I are going to go through every single one of them. We're going to look at every proof text that the pre-trib camp has ever used or ever will use. And there's not a lot of them. And the ones that they do use are really, really bad. And they don't communicate anything even close to a pre-tribulation rapture teaching. So the first vantage point we're going to get, the first, you know, mountaintop we're going to go up to look at this issue of the second coming and the gathering of the saints is going to be the Bible. What's the Bible say about it? Now, the good thing is there's only four passages in the whole Bible that describe the rapture, that name the rapture and describe it. Now, there's other passages that refer to the gathering of the saints, but there's only four that emphasize the exact timing and nature of that. We're going to look at those four in detail. We'll take a session on each one. But the fact of the matter is this, it's not in the Bible. And I'm aware some of you watching this who may be leaning towards pre-trib may be going, you can't just say that and move on. Well, I'm going to, because this is the reason we're doing a whole study on it, is because we're going to take each session, we're going to look at the Bible. Then we're going to take some sessions and look at church history. We're going to go through the evidence. Now, there have been some really goofy books written about this. There's a quote-unquote scholarly book written by a cohort of pre-tribulation rapture scholars. They call themselves scholars. They're not scholars, but they're referred to as scholars within the pre-tribulation camp, which is kind of goofy in and of itself. But anyway, they make the case for the historicity of the pre-tribulation teaching, but they don't have any history. So it's really, really awkward that the scholars of the movement wrote a book about the historicity, but they don't have any. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to address these guys head on. We're going to address the books. We're going to name the names and the camps, and we're going to go very specifically into this thing, and we're going to begin to take the stones and uncover them and look under the hood, so to speak, because you can't make claims and not verify them. And the pre-tribulation rapture camp is incredibly guilty of this, making huge claims or making very terrible arguments to distract from the fact that their claims are full of holes. For example, you'll hear this a lot. People will go, but Paul said that we would be saved from the wrath. Yeah, Paul did say that we were going to be saved from the wrath of God. That's kind of like a main emphasis point of the New Testament, if you didn't catch that, is that Jesus bore the wrath of God on the cross for us so that we didn't have to bear the wrath of God. So we don't bear the wrath of God. The tribulation's not the wrath of God for the saints. It's the great tribulation. The wrath of God that will be poured out upon the wicked at the end of the age is not the tribulation. this is a bad argument, and this is like one of the central arguments, is that Paul said that we'd be saved from wrath. The context of that verse has nothing to do with the rapture, nothing to do with the rapture. Yet it's been put in the central place on the mantle, so to speak, to say, see, he said that. You know, another one is, well, God wouldn't abuse his bride before the wedding day. You know, this is akin to saying the father wouldn't abuse his son on the cross. And these two doctrines go hand in hand. The cosmic child abuse theory, you know, that denies that Jesus suffered on the cross, the wrath of God. This goes hand in hand with the illogical nature and mocking nature of the pre-tribulation rapture teaching, that God is somehow abusing his bride by forcing her to go through the tribulation. Nothing could be further from the truth. All over the New Testament, we have this issue of the endurance of the saints and the powerful catalytic nature of tribulation and what it causes in the beautification and the maturity of the church. We have this all over the New Testament, which is why we're calling this series The Rapture and the Endurance of the Saints, because the central message concerning the church at the end of the age during the tribulation is not that we evacuate, it's that we endure. And this is the clash of worldviews that's going on with the rapture camp right now. Evacuation or endurance? Is your central hope in the days ahead that you're going to get evacuated while everyone else drinks the wrath of God while you conveniently eat popcorn in heaven? Or are you going to endure? Are you going to walk as Jesus walked among the people while they're suffering? And through your witness, the Lord is going to give the greatest demonstration of the power of the cross and of resurrection in all of church history. We're going to look at all of these proof texts about why the church gets evacuated. And at the end of this thing, if you're honest with yourself and before the Lord, and if you're open-handed, you're going to come to the conclusion that evacuation is a false, toxic teaching by the end of this thing, because you're not going to find it in the Bible. Well, Dalton, what about Revelation 3:10, where it says that we'll da 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 da? What is it? What do you mean about 2 Thessalonians, where it says that we're going to be taken away, the restrainer? We're going to look at all these passages. Don't worry. We're going to look at all of them, and all of these passages. This is the crazy thing to me about the pre-tribulation rapture thing. The proof texts that the pre-tribulation rapture camp has chosen to be like their central, you know, meat and potatoes are so emphatic about the need for endurance and so emphatic about the inseparable nature of the rapture and the second coming, meaning it's one event. The Bible doesn't separate it. And it doesn't say that Jesus has three comings, you know, because if he came the first time to die on the cross and then he comes again in a secret phantom rapture to take everybody, then he comes again the third time, you're dealing with three comings of Jesus, not two. That's kind of a logical, theological problem. And if you're going to, you know, force that, you're going to have to really find some good arguments for three comings of Jesus, because once you start to say it out loud and frame it in an objective, non-theological, campy way, you go, wait a minute, three comings of Jesus in like a phantom secret one and people's clothes fall off? Like, what is that? The illogical nature of this thing, without being, we don't want to shame anybody. We don't want to call anybody stupid. That's not in Joel and I's heart. We don't want to do that. However, it's going to feel like that for some people who have believed this for so long, because it's always painful when someone comes and tells you, actually, that's not true. And you get defensive about it. It's human nature. And I understand that. And I've gone through this on many things myself, where I believe that someone comes and goes, actually, that's not true. And then they explain it and you're like, oh my gosh. I have the option now to just dig in and fight them and argue them, even though I know that it's wrong. And I'm going to close my mind to it, or I'm going to open my mind to it and consider the possibility that maybe I have been misled. Maybe the possibility, not to blame, misled means it's someone else's fault, or I've misunderstood, in which case it's on me. I think there's both going on with the pre-tribulation rapture teaching. I think people have misled people by standing in pulpits and teaching this, So there is guilt, but there's also misunderstanding that people just didn't know any better. So they sat there and they heard it and they listened and they went, okay, sounds good, sounds logical. Until someone comes along and says, really? But one of the best ways that, unfortunately, one of the best ways that you can come to the realization that you've believed something that's illogical is when someone comes in and shows the illogical nature of it. So Joel and I are going to do that. We're going to take these arguments. We're going to take the books. We're going to take the movies, the documentaries, the teaching series. And we're going to name the names of the teachers who have gone through this. And again, it's not to expose them, shame them, demonize them. It's to address the issue head on in a respectful way, but in a way that I think Paul would do. In a way that I think the apostles would do in the New Testament. If they say, no, that guy taught that thing. That's not the thing. Now, what we fail to realize sometimes is that a majority of the New Testament was written because of this. Meaning he writes 2 Thessalonians, he goes, hey guys, listen, I heard there's some people saying some stuff about the second coming in here that's not true, so I'm gonna counter it. The book of Jude, he's writing to counter false doctrine about the end of the age. 2 Peter, I'm writing to counter false doctrine about the end of the age. 1 Corinthians, hey guys, I'm writing to you to clarify the confusion that has been stirred up because of false teaching and misunderstandings about the return of the Lord. The majority of your New Testament, guys, was written to clarify eschatological confusion and dysfunction within the community that was brought on because of it. Very important point. So it's not in the Bible, vantage point. It's not in church history, and it's not in the persecuted church. So we're going to also look at the fruit of evacuation versus endurance teachings in the persecuted church. Joel and I have had the privilege of working very closely with the persecuted church in many different countries and different continents and different cultures. And over again, we see this thread running throughout all these communities, regardless of where they are culturally, their background, regardless. We see this dynamic, vibrant passion for endurance. You will not find hunger for evacuation. That is a luxury that only Americans get to enjoy. Because the rest of the world, guys, is already in tribulation right now. They're just not in the great tribulation. So their hope is not evacuation. Their hope is Jesus coming in flaming fire and restoring all things. Evacuate, they're not interested in evacuation. You know who's interested in evacuation? Americans who go to Walmart and go to the movie theater and who go to McDonald's and Chick-fil-A and who are driving a BMW and who are talking about how God would never abuse his bride. That's the kind of people that are awaiting evacuation. The kind of people that are enduring right now, or I should say this, the kind of people that are walking in the gospel of endurance are the people who are enduring right now. And you say, well, Dalton, look, America's going through hard times right now. You know, COVID, the government, financially, economically, I'm aware of that. I'm aware of that, guys. But I'm telling you, I've been around the world, and I can tell you this, for all of the hardships the United States of America is going through right now, you can't hold a candle to a place like Lebanon or Yemen or Afghanistan or Syria. You need endurance in those countries like you don't need in the U.S. You need endurance in the U.S., but a different kind of endurance. You're going to have to endure false teaching. You're going to have to endure prosperity. You're going to have to endure all of the options. That's a different kind of endurance, and you're going to need that kind of endurance. And that's exactly why Joel and I want to do this study, is because I believe that the Lord is going to bring together the persecuted church and the affluent church of the West in the days ahead. And he's going to bind us together through, by the way, the Great Tribulation. But we need to be prepared for it. We need to wipe the hard drives and deprogram and reprogram and get ready for what's coming. So, three applications and then three caveats, and we'll wrap this up. Three applications. Number one, you need to be anchored. The goal of this study is to look at what the Bible says so that you personally would be anchored in the great hope of the gospel. And to the degree that you believe in a pre-tribulation rapture teaching is to the degree that you don't have an anchor. You don't have an anchor. You're going to be set up for disillusionment, offense, potentially falling away because of the disillusionment and the offense when all of these things begin to unfold and all that you had held dear turned out to be a lie, that is going to cause a considerable falling away. A considerable falling away in the Western world is going to be believing and waiting for the central thing, and then it doesn't happen. Because if you've made the rapture your great hope, and your great hope is dashed, what are you left with? That's what I mean by the toxic nature of this teaching. It's heavy, guys. Like, there's really lives are on the line here on this thing. This isn't like, you know, you're in a spelling bee here and you're just going to get to go home afterwards and you got first place or second place. That's not what's happening here. This is going to have real emotional, psychological, spiritual, internal implications. Your soul needs to be anchored to truth and to reality and to the gospel, and not some false teaching that emerged over the last 200 years that the Western world, in their opulence and affluence and prosperity, had the luxury of grasping onto and white knuckling till this present day. You need to be anchored. That's the first application. The second application of this series is for you to anchor others, for you to anchor others. Meaning what we're hoping for is that you as an individual, regardless of your vocation, your location, regardless of the size of your influence, whether it's your kids, your family, your business, your church, you would live and walk in a way where you could just ooze clarity.
Hey friends, wanted to interrupt very briefly just to call your attention to the FAI Outfitter and Supply Company. Not only do we here at FAI value the completion of the Great Commission, but we've also always valued quality artwork, quality craftsmanship, quality artisanship. And so with that in mind, we've created the FAI Outfitter and Supply Company. We've got all sorts of cool merchandise and clothing and hats and artwork and all sorts of neat things. It's really great. So not only does this give you an opportunity to identify with this Maranatha message and to share it with people abroad, you know, it's a great opportunity. What does that on your hat mean? What is Maranatha? Well, let me explain to you what it means, this type of thing. But when you buy these products, you're also helping to fund and support those missionaries that are on the ground fulfilling the Great Commission. So again, FAI Outfitter and Supply Company, go to faistudios.org, click the link at the bottom of the video. Thank you so much. Back to the teaching.
Where you could, wherever you go, you're giving off the clarity of what's coming. That's what we're aiming for here. It's not that, you know, Joel and I can like grow our YouTube channel. At the heart of this thing is we believe Ephesians 5 is true, that the church will be in splendor presented to Jesus at the end of the age, in splendor. If the church is going to be presented in splendor at the end of the age, it means she's going to be ready. She's going to be anchored. She's going to be clean. She's going to be radiant. If that's going to happen, then we need to be prepared individually, but then we need to prepare others. So a big part of this is going to be arming you and equipping you and resourcing you to engage with this, with people who don't know anything about anything, so that you can onboard them quickly, and as well so that you can engage with people who are like, you know, I don't really know what I believe, but you know, I don't think it matters, that you could engage. And then the third application here is so that you can warn those who have been misled or who are currently in a place of misunderstanding, that you could warn them. Now, I've had the beautiful privilege of witnessing, I don't know, I don't want to say hundreds, but it's a lot. It's a lot of people, both from, you know, just moms and dads to like leaders of big organizations and ministries and denominations. I've had the privilege of watching them realize the pre-tribulation rapture teaching is false, number one. And number two, watching people come into the hope of the gospel of the kingdom, of Jesus' second coming and the Maranatha message, watching people come alive with that is something profound. So it's not just warning people, it's also connecting people who right now are connected to a lie. And lies don't give life. They energize you, like lies energize you for sure, but they don't give you life and set you on fire. And the Maranatha message of the return of the Lord is going to set a lot of people on fire. And it's in a good way. And we need to warn people to turn from the lies, but to embrace the truth and the reality. And it's going to cause a lot of hearts to be warmed in the days ahead. So to be anchored ourselves, to anchor other people, and as well to warn people. And in the warning of people, there's going to be a big turning, I believe. I believe there's a mass exodus out of the pre-tribulation rapture teaching coming, number one. And number two, I believe that there is a massive awakening coming to the Maranatha message globally of this hope, that this is the central hope. Nothing else. This is the central hope, that he's coming, and that his coming is everything. And if it doesn't feel like everything to you right now, it's because you don't understand it. Because you've been misled, or because you've misunderstood it, or because you've just never interacted with it before. And our hope through this series is that not only would you, the goal is not just that you would see that the pre-tribulation rapture teaching is wrong, is that you would fall in love with the Lord and the message of his return, and you would see it in all of its vibrant glory, all of its radiance and power, all of its consequence. You would feel it, because this is everything, guys. This is the gospel. This is the hope. This is the story. So I want to give three caveats and we'll wrap it up. Number one, good people believe the pre-tribulation rapture teaching. Good people don't really care about which one's true. And good people aren't even aware that there's a debate about it because they never really heard about it. So the first caveat here is like, they're good people. Joel and I are not, you know, I have very dear friends who are very passionate about the pre-tribulation rapture teaching. So we're not, Joel and I are not saying if you believe it, you're a terrible person or you're demonized or you're an enemy or you're not a brother or a sister or you're not a believer. We're going to be honest and tell you we believe that a great falling away is coming and that there is a cause-effect dynamic to this thing for sure. But I believe that there's going to be a lot of good people who, when this happens, they're not going to curse God and fall away. They're going to have been warned and they're going to go, we were wrong. And they'll turn on a dime. They'll turn on a dime because they're sensitive to the Lord. They've just been misled. They've just been misled. And that's the thing. Nobody has ever discovered the pre-tribulation rapture teaching without having been taught it. This is probably, to me, one of the strongest arguments against the pre-tribulation rapture teaching is that I've never met a single person who believes it because they came up with it by reading the Bible. You know, if you like, you read the Bible by yourself, you don't, you know, you read John 18, you don't need someone to come teach you that Jesus was crucified. You read it and you go, yeah, so, okay, he was crucified. It's a story. I've never read it before, but it appears to be a story about a guy who was crucified. You get it on your own, right? Now, if you impose something else on that story, you could maybe teach it and explain it, but you got to teach it. And that's something profound about this whole debacle of the pre-tribulation rapture teaching. Everyone who believes it because they were taught it. And so it is an issue of mass misleading. Having said that, there will be falling away, but there will also be responsiveness. And this is why we want to sow the seeds now, because I know that when the season flips, there's going to be a lot of people who are going to go, I missed this thing. I was wrong. And now I have to endure. Okay, Lord, I'm in. Let's do it. And people are going to flip quickly. So there are good people in this who believe it. Now, some of those good people are going to fall away. Because good people fall away. And some of these good people are going to, and I'm using the word good people to be affectionate and respectful. Because now you could, you know, for the Pharisees who are watching this, who are going to respond in the comment section, they're going to say, Jesus said no one's good. And Paul said, I get the point. I understand sinfulness of man. Please understand my point. My point is to say that we have no intention in demonizing people who don't agree with our eschatology. And we believe that just being a good person may or may not be enough for you to respond when the season shifts. So the point is this, we all need the fear of the Lord. We all need the fear of the Lord. Second caveat, the rapture doctrine cannot save your soul. Joel and I are not presenting this as if this was the basis upon which we are saved, the basis upon which that we have fellowship, the basis upon which that we're going to stand around the throne in the age to come. It's not that. This is not that thing. However, this can affect those things, because the scripture is full of warnings concerning things that if you do this or don't do this, that it could have eternal consequences. I use the issue of Israel as an example. I've had people oftentimes say, like, come on. The emphasis of the Bible is not on loving the Jews. The emphasis is loving on Jesus. So why are you making this such a thing? Like, why make the Israel issue such a big thing? And I say, well, couple reasons. Couple like really important passages in the New Testament, like Romans 11 or Matthew 25, describe eternal consequences for mistreating the Jewish people. Romans 11, Paul says that if you're arrogant against unbelieving Jews, the Lord will cut you off and throw you in the fire. Matthew 25 says that if you don't care for the least of Jesus's brethren, the context of that is suffering Jews at the end of the age in the Great Tribulation. If you don't care for them, he's going to put you with the goats. It's kind of a big deal. And the point is this, it's not as though Jesus is determining your eternal destiny based on how you feel and what you think about the Jewish people. What he's saying is what you think and feel about the Jewish people is a litmus test and is a indicator of the authenticity of your love for Jesus. Because if you say you love Jesus and Jesus says, stand with the Jewish people in their suffering, and you say, I don't want to, you don't love Jesus. You love the idea of you loving Jesus. And it's very, very different. And the pre-tribulation rapture teaching, I think, is in the similar vein, meaning you may think you love the Lord, but in reality, you love some sort of Americanized gospel that allows you to have your cake and eat it too and deceive yourself into believing that you're a fiery Christian, when in reality, you're just a nominal, casual, garden variety, cultural Christian who happens to have really dug in on one of the most convenient doctrines in American Christendom, the doctrine that says you're going to get evacuated before things get hard. It might mean that you're actually just shallow, all too shallow, and American, all too American, and you're not actually a follower of Jesus. Now, that's not up for me to decide. What's up for me to decide is how I'm going to obey the radical commands of Jesus in the New Testament over my life. And the rapture teaching does affect a lot of those. And as I said before, if the central hope of your religious worldview is evacuation before things get hard, and your understanding of the nature and character of God is that he would evacuate you before things get hard, you're in for a rude awakening. And when that rude awakening happens, you might find yourself in a very different space than you are right now in terms of your own self-identity and self-awareness. And that's a sobering reality. The last caveat in this, before we wrap this up, is this. The goal of this series is not to win arguments, but it's to win people. Joel and I are carrying a pastoral, prophetic, evangelistic, apostolic burden. And I frame it that way because in Ephesians chapter 4, Paul describes the fivefold dynamic of the saints operating amongst each other, that this is the mysterious nature of the church. She is apostolic, she's prophetic, she's evangelistic, she teaches, she shepherds. We're carrying burdens for these dimensions of leadership in the body. Looking at the implications and ramifications of this, we want to win people, not arguments, in terms of an apostolic. Meaning, what's the implications of an endurance-oriented gospel on the apostolic nature of the body? Prophetic, what's the implications of a, not an evacuation-oriented gospel, but an endurance-oriented gospel? What's the implications of that prophetically? How about in terms of evangelism, evangelistically? Are we evangelizing in a way that's saying, hey, you guys are going to be evacuated? Or are we saying, you need to endure? That we preach a message of the cross and of the crown. He came once to bleed, he's coming again to rule and reign. That's the gospel. So what is it that we're calling people into pastorally? You know, one of the most convincing things about the, for me, about why to abandon the pre-tribulation rapture teaching is actually because of the pastoral epistles. When you go through the New Testament, you look at the pastoral writings of the apostles, you see very quickly, whoa, like they're using the second coming for basic like life issues, like family, community, food, hospitality. They're using the second coming as the basis for pastoral leadership in the body. It's profound. And then as well, teaching. What are we teaching people? Are we misleading them, or are we feeding them food in due season? So again, Joel and I's burden in this thing is to win people, not win arguments. But sometimes to win people, you got to win the arguments. So Joel and I are going to lay out the argumentation over the next, I don't know how many sessions this will be, 20, 30, 40, I don't know. We're going to get rolling. I know Joel has a long list of sessions. I've got a pretty decent list as well of sessions that I'll be bringing to the table, and Joel and I will be alternating, and we're going to hit this and we're going to throw everything in the kitchen sink at this thing. So we're going to make the arguments, but our goal in making these arguments is not to win the argument. We want to win people, and we want you to win people as well, because the days are short and the implications of this thing are catastrophic. So guys, thanks for watching this inaugural session on the rapture and the endurance of the saints. We'll be back the same day next week to jump into our first session. Blessings from the Golan Heights and Maranatha.